I don't want to analyze what people think opposed to what they do, but what they think when they do what they are doing. What I want to analyze is the meaning they give to their own behavior, the way they integrate their behavior in general strategies, the type of rationality they recognize in their different practices, institutions, models, and behavior.
Welcome, I'm Ben Boyce, and this is the Dr. Junkie Show. I want to start with a claim that you might find hard to believe. You live in a prison. Don't believe me? By the end of this episode, you might. But let's start at the beginning. Let's say you have a group of people who you need to control. Take your pick, a classroom full of fifth graders, a prison full of criminals, or a city full of citizens. And let's say those people are like most groups of people. Some of them are willing to follow the rules and play it cool, even if they don't always like it. Let's call these folks docile, as in not yelling, throwing stuff, or acting up. And then you'll have a subset of people who just can't seem to follow the rules. They'll cut in the chow line, steal extra rations, bully others in the group, exploit and manipulate those they see as weaker than themselves, try to escape, all kinds of nasty humanness. You better come up with some way to keep these people in line, or you're quickly going to have a problem. That brings me to philosopher Jeremy Bentham, who died in 1832, even though his head is still stored in a glass jar at the University College in London. It's got a hole in the top of it because, for a long time, it was attached to his body and publicly displayed in the college's foyer. The hole in the top of his head was from a steel rod with a bolt on top to hold it in place. You can find lots of weird videos of both the booth he was displayed in for years and the head being examined. They remove it from the jar once a year to document decay. The head on the body was swapped out some time ago with a fake one because of that decay, and when the fake head body was put back into the college in a public place, cameras were installed that live-streamed the hallway and the foot traffic around the body. And in response, people started to act different when they knew that Bentham, or that the cameras in Bentham's body, were watching. And that's the topic of today's episode, panoptic power. Optic meaning visibility, and pan meaning feeling like it comes from everywhere. Panoptic. As always, my goal is to talk about deep theory in a way that people like me, people who don't understand why Foucault has to use such difficult language to explain things, language we can understand. And of course, I also don't care much for any theory or story that doesn't impact my life personally in a real way, so I also always aim to apply these theories to real-life scenarios, especially scenarios related to crime, prison, and the war on drugs. So let's dive in. So Jeremy Bentham, the head in the jar guy, he's credited with inventing the idea of the panopticon, a circular prison with a single guard tower in the middle that's completely encased in one-way glass. You can see out of the guard tower, but you can't see in. Now, if you build the cells with all the doors facing inward toward the guard tower, you can effectively surveil every inmate in that prison with just one guard, said Bentham. But it gets better than that, because the shape of the structure, the building, and the one-way glass that restricts inmates from looking in, from knowing whether they're being watched right now or not, that design forces the inmates to assume that they're always being watched. It becomes a mental game. You can look at the tower all you want, but you'll never know if someone is looking back at you right now. And the real magic? Eventually you don't even need a guard in the tower. The inmates will discipline themselves under the assumption that they're being watched. In other words, you can build a system in such a way as to control the behavior and the beliefs of those within it. Now, Bentham was a weird guy, obviously, considering his head's final resting place, but his ideas stuck with another philosopher born more than 100 years later, Michel Foucault. In the 1970s, he used Bentham as a kicking-off point for what's perhaps his best-known book, called Discipline and Punish, The Birth of the Prison. Foucault grabs this idea of prisons shaped in a circle, a panopticon, as Bentham called it, And he says, yeah, Bentham's right, but his theory of architecture influencing behavior is much bigger than just in a prison environment. The entire world now works like a panopticon, said Foucault. We don't need the circular structures and the guards threatening us with solitary confinement anymore, because we now fear oversight and surveillance no matter where we're at. We expect it so much that we largely discipline ourselves to avoid the embarrassment of getting in trouble. Now let's play with that idea for a minute, because it sounds extraordinary, but it's actually pretty easy to spot. You're running late to a meeting with an important person, and as you walk from your car to the building, you think to yourself, is my zipper undone? Of course you'd be embarrassed if it wasn't someone noticed. In fact, you're kind of embarrassed already, because in your mind, someone might already have noticed. A stranger in that car that just parked, a rider on the bus you just walked past, a surveillance camera with a curious operator and an incredible zoom lens. Why do you care if your zipper is undone? Well, because it's kind of a rule that we all follow to help other people feel more comfortable, because it's awkward to sit next to somebody whose shirt is curly-cued through their belt line. But there's even more panoptic power at work, because chances are you also won't feel comfortable checking your zipper in public, or even looking down at it, because that, too, is part of our cultural code. The rules say zip up before you present yourself to the public. Be a docile, obedient body, follow the rules, and do it right the first time or you will be surveilled, outed, and disciplined. That's Foucault's theory. Now, what does he mean by discipline? I mean, given our example, it's unlikely a cop is going to come flying up on you, lights and sirens blaring, and arrest you for failing to properly secure your zipper or for checking it in public. But you might get a side eye or a snicker from two teens you didn't notice exiting a nearby vehicle, a kid on that bus pointing at you and sticking out his tongue. And in real time, in your mind, you have to balance that fear with the possible discipline of this important person who might actually see your pants unzipped if you turned out to be right, and if you don't check them. I mean, maybe you won't get that promotion next year, or maybe they'll choose someone else to handle that important project next month. Oh no. Discipline takes place largely in our heads nowadays. We panoptically discipline ourselves under the assumption that we're always being watched from every angle. Now this presents a huge question. If it's not me, then who gets to decide which things I self-discipline for and which things I don't care about? If I thought, maybe I left my wipers on when I turned the car off, or did I put my keys in the same pocket as my cell phone? I better change them to avoid scratching the screen. Or a whole lot of other hypothetical thoughts that go through all of our minds all the time. The guilt and self-discipline wouldn't have showed up. I wouldn't care if anyone saw me switch my keys from one pocket to the other because I don't live in a culture where that sort of behavior is disciplined. It's not on the list. Now, could someone add that to the list of don't do this in public, the list the zipper is on, if they wanted? Could they make me feel ashamed for forgetting to turn off my wipers or for switching my keys from one pocket to the other in public? Foucault's theories are far-reaching, but his main goal in life seemed to be refusing to be governed by any of these pre-existing, non-chosen institutional forces of panoptic power. This is allowed and this is not allowed, says society. But Foucault says the more we say, fuck that, I'm going to do it even if it's not allowed because I want to, the more we achieve freedom. And in many ways, he lived by that commitment. He frequented sadomasochist sex clubs in San Francisco, and he eventually died of AIDS before completing what might be his most controversial work, The History of Sexuality, in which he suggests that even our taboos and norms about sexuality, things like the age of consent, sexual assault, gay and straight, they are all socially constructed and should therefore be challenged. In 1978, Foucault was smoking opium, and he was hit by a car. He had what he described as a near-death experience that made him realize there's no need to fear death. And in a weird way, that seemed to be, again, a snapshot of his overall career ambitions, to explain why things we take for granted, fearing death, knowing evil when we see it, conceptions of sexuality, understandings of disease and mental illness, expecting those who break the law to be punished, feeling like we should zip up our pants in public. Those things are all mental constructs that prevent us from thinking outside the box. They all exclude certain behaviors that we're not allowed to perform, beliefs we're not allowed to have. They work to mold us into what are seen as good citizens who respect the proper exclusions, the no-no spaces, declared by law or by stigma, the things they tell us we're not allowed to touch, to believe, to do. Only by criticizing, questioning, and challenging all taken-for-granted systems of belief and power, says Foucault, can you even get close to something like true freedom. Shaking things up by, I don't know, smoking opium and maybe nearly getting killed while you're doing it, things like that quickly reveal the, quote, invisible and unverifiable nature of panoptic power, to use Foucault's words. He could see in that moment that at least one institutional belief, fear of death, supported by the church, by the medical profession, by the lack of knowledge which makes us so anxious in panoptic cultures, that it was fabricated, constructed, a complete illusion that melted away the second he challenged it. Now, at the time of that accident, Foucault had just published Discipline and Punish, that famous book I talked about a minute ago, but he'd been talking about these ideas for a long time, claiming that discourses, stories, anchored to knowledge by the glue of institutional endorsement, those are the stuff of power. His focus was institutional power, which of course means power that comes from schools, prisons, hospitals, churches, institutions. But his theory that discourses legitimize or stigmatize behavior, that the stories we tell ourselves and others about the world defend what would otherwise often be ghastly treatment of others, that theory goes much further than just institutions. It's everywhere. It's also pretty easy to spot. For example, Foucault examined the idea of madness or insanity, and he noted that we once honored and respected those with mental illness, looking closely at their mysterious words and actions for clues that they might carry messages from the gods or from the afterlife. If you see a mad person in a Shakespeare play, they're probably about to drop some important knowledge, so pay attention. During that time, when the mentally ill were seen as special, public discourse rationalized public behavior. If you asked a citizen what they thought about the mentally ill man up the block, they'd describe him as touched by the gods or in contact with some realm that the rest of us just can't access. Now roll the clock forward, and many European cultures go through a long period where Christians hijacked that discourse and we all, for example, burned epileptics at the stake for being possessed by demons. That would have been the story told by those who witnessed it at the time, the public discourse that backed up and rationalized treating people in ways that might otherwise have been seen as horrific. I mean, these people were, after all, dangerous and demonic. They had to be killed. And of course, nowadays, we live in a medicalized discourse, where physical and mental conditions are labeled, studied, treated, and tracked by the medical institution writ large. If someone told you the epileptic living up the street from you should be burned to death for demon possession, you'd be shocked because that's not the story, the discourse that we use to explain what's going on in that person's body anymore. Discourses are knowledge certified by institutions, and knowledge is power. If you're a priest who's coming to burn an epileptic, the fact that the public and the powers that be have the same story you do, the same discourse, that gives you the authority to burn. Foucault would here, too, point out that the most visible forms of power are those that excluded, that said no. Power that said, you are not allowed to be here on earth if you do that unacceptable thing. Zip up your pants before you leave the house. When power is productive, on the other hand, when it tells us what we should do instead of what we should not do, it remains mostly cloaked in normativity. It just feels like that's the way things are. That's how you control a group of people. You trick them into controlling themselves by making them feel compelled by unseen forces to behave in certain ways and to not behave in other ways. Now think about how we remember criminals in the United States. We often heroize them in an odd way, almost like we see in them something that was not available to most of us, an ability to tell their own story, their own discourse, that is often so far outside of the norm that it lands them in prison or even the morgue. Billy the Kid, Al Capone, Jeffrey Epstein, Jeffrey Dahmer, Charles Manson, BTK, they all have this sticky fame attached to them that bears fruit in the way of, wait for it, discourse. Movies, books, articles, news exposés. And those discourses, according to Foucault, must back up and get in line with the status quo institutional discourse of the time. The agreed upon story of our era that one must remain within the bounds of if you want to avoid discipline from other institutions. In the case of criminality, another label Foucault focused on a lot because it, too, has changed so much over the decades. The status quo of our era says criminals should be locked up and punished, reformed cheaply if possible, and forced to conform to social norms whether they're ever released or not. Because of that, you can't publish a book that praises BTK's killings of innocent people or labels him as normal or heroic. But you can publish a book that pathologizes BTK, that classifies him as outside the norm using institutional labels that gain their power from institutional affiliations. Psychology says he was a narcissistic psychotic. Neurology says he had frontal cortex damage that inhibited his ability to accurately consider consequences. Religion says he was tempted by the same forces that the rest of us are tempted by, but he didn't have the strength to resist. Acceptable discourses must conform to the rules of the status quo. So Dylann Roof shoots up a synagogue, the nightly news covers the story for a couple days, then Frontline does two or three specials alongside a few books detailing the discourse of criminality and the social deviance we saw. We get the "he was a creepy neighbor" from the Citizens, in the "I'd have diagnosed him with this or that" opinion from a medical professional, and the "this kid was pure evil" from the prosecutor, and the "his mother probably didn't love him" from a psychiatrist. Having gathered these scraps of socially acceptable discourse that we can all use now to adequately explain this event, we simply move on. The discourses survive way longer than the people they describe, and they offer us a way to understand the next shocking challenge to the status quo that we come across. The next mass shooting. Maybe he's a psychotic, like Dylann Roof was. I bet his neighbors saw this coming. This, Foucault says, is a result of our current cultural norm of understanding the world through discourses of knowledge that are all, sadly, built to reinforce institutional power. And to add the frosting on the cake that often makes people say Foucault went too far, since all rules and norms inevitably benefit someone, I mean, even my zipper being fastened makes my boss feel more comfortable, Foucault says we can never trust any norm, any discourse that rationalizes or restricts a rule or a behavior. We must, he says, challenge everything. Now let's add a piece to this that I've already hinted at. Those of us who behave want to hear the stories, the discourses, of those who don't. We love the criminals. Well, why is that? Well, since we feel like we're following the zip up your pants before you leave home, and for God's sake, don't check your zipper in public rules, and since we feel like we're doing so for a good reason, but at the same time, we also feel like we can't for the life of us figure out what that reason is. I mean, what if we're wrong? What if there is no good reason to behave, to be docile and play along with the status quo norms of society? Billy the Kid might have been onto something, and Al Capone's ability to not follow the rules which he found inconvenient, it feels kind of attractive because I'm finding myself following all these rules for behaviors that I don't understand, feeling compelled to regulate myself all day in ways I don't even agree with. And honestly, I don't know where these compulsions are coming from. Someone help me make sense of this. I want to check my zipper. And then we read Bonnie and Clyde were riddled with bullets while still in their car, and that Al Capone died of syphilis in prison, and suddenly we feel peace. Ah, I've actually been doing the right thing all along. Foucault says that those in power need docile bodies who are willing to follow rules they don't understand, and that docile bodies are shaped by discourses that remind them why they're being docile, why they're following the rules of no zipper checking in public, or why they even care that their zipper is up at all. It's pretty deep, right? But the idea of docile bodies actually goes deeper. So let's wade in just a few more steps by applying it to the war on drugs. So docile bodies are just bodies that are following the rules. But it turns out that the rules are different for everyone in an actual culture. There are pathways, like metaphoric sidewalks, that all of us use to get through institutional spaces. And every space is an institutional space. The streets, college campuses, your job, the supermarket, church, everywhere. If you step off those pathways that are marked for you, you risk discipline. And discipline can be anything from mean looks, side eyes, to arrest and imprisonment for life. And it's no exaggeration to say that all of us have very different pathways through each institution. The police chief's son has a very different pathway through the police station, or through the legal system if he's pulled over drunk, than the son of the most hated criminal in town. The homeless man trying to use a bathroom on my college campus has a very different pathway available to him than a well-dressed 22-year-old student. And stepping afoul of your allowed pathway, that can be a real problem. Making things more complicated, the pathway I use might be invisible to you. In fact, many of them almost certainly are. And the pathways you use are probably hard for me to spot. You never know what it's like to work for a business until you actually work there. And then you usually realize you imagined very different pathways to daily success than what you actually travel. Like maybe your boss cusses a lot more than you'd expected, or the copy room supplies are unguarded after 3 p.m. Things that you only learn when you're there. And already you can see why Foucault's ideas of power are squishy, hard to grasp, but enticingly informative. It really feels like there's a truth here that gives us a way to better our lives and to better our world, to expand our institutional paths in the paths of others, or to maybe blow them all up. So these pathways are obvious to us when we use them, but they're hard to spot when we don't, unless you know where to look. We've all heard stories of black men being arrested for petty crimes, like drugs, only to be released with no charges when the cops realize they're the starting quarterback for Notre Dame. We've all heard stories of Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein walking pathways that most of us thought were trenches of certain cultural death, because to us, they would have been. Most of us aren't millionaires who can use their wealth to get away with that sort of awful behavior. But with the titles those people possess comes power, institutional power, the ability to move things, in this case, themselves, through otherwise non-navigable spaces, like the criminal justice system. And it really doesn't matter who the police chief's son is or the starting quarterback is this year. They'll both be treated a certain way because of the titles they possess, because of the institutional associations they can lean on in the way those who encounter them understand those associations. Foucault's main point in all of his work is that knowledge and power are intertwined. Here's another example. If I told you, I take heroin 15 times a day intravenously, I also work out Joe Rogan style for 3 hours a day while sleeping just 6 hours every night because I want to save time for the 300 pages I commit to read every day, you'd be lost halfway through that sentence if you're an average listener because that sentence doesn't make sense. In your mind, unless you've had personal life experience that challenged the status quo story that's currently offered by institutional power, you probably think heroin users can't do those things. The acceptable discourse of heroin use has borders in your mind's eye, edges that cannot be crossed without firing your bullshit detector. If I'd have said, I take heroin and I drink 3 sodas a day, or I take heroin and I sleep 10 hours a night, your bullshit detector wouldn't have gone off because our public narratives about heroin use make lots of space for sleeping too much and for drinking soda. Those things are within the discourse borders that you're familiar with regarding heroin use. But reading, working out, sleeping less and not more, Come on, Dr. Boyce, you're pulling my leg. According to Foucault, when it comes to how power works nowadays, that's it. I mean, positions like president, executive, and business owner exist, but when you take a deeper look at why these institutional positions work the way they do, it's easy to spot the foundational role of institutional-backed knowledge. How I feel and what I believe informs how I treat people. It doesn't really matter who fills the role of president or CEO or business owner at any given moment. The knowledge that the president, no matter who they are, can bomb my country, it impacts my decision to act. The knowledge that the CEO can overrule any decision compels me to draft my proposal to their interests. The knowledge that the owner of the business where I work has installed surveillance cameras and can fire me anytime for anything compels me to behave, and to behave according to the business owner's standards. If I know that the man who just walked in is the business owner, I'll act in accordance with that knowledge, even if he doesn't own the business and I just think he does. And that's the terrifying magic of Foucault's theory. It both gives us a way to understand how power works and why things happen the way they do, but it also gives us a way to manipulate the masses, especially if the masses don't read Foucault, and they don't. Hence Foucault's seemingly extreme claim that all discourses should be challenged because all discourses benefit people who, because they're being benefited, can't help but support and try to advance those causes. Upton Sinclair, the guy who wrote The Jungle in 1905, once said when running for political office that it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his livelihood depends very much on him not understanding it. You don't have to be a bad guy to look the other way when policies or norms benefit you at the expense of others. Foucault can be a lot, but I like to use his theories as a way to play with the notion of free will, among other things. He's taking a social historical perspective in explaining why neurons work as they work without much wiggle room for freely selected choices absent any pressure from the things we experience. We can't help how we feel when someone asks us to, say, attend a dog fight or visit a loved one in the hospital. We say yes or no based on how we feel about the proposition. Per Foucault, how we feel about any proposition, kick the dog, steal that car, give $5 to the panhandler, brush your teeth before bed, pray before dinner, take some heroin because you're feeling a little down. Those feelings and the decisions that stem from them come from discourses that were created by humans to further their Nietzschean will for power, the human desire to control everything and everyone around them. Now back to those drug stereotypes. Imagine what people would have said in, say, 1875 if you tried to convince them that the morphine Grandpop was using to take away some of the pain from his old war injury, or that the cannabis tincture Aunt Bessie was drinking to help with her menstrual cramps, that these things were evil or sinful, or that they would make Granny lose her mind and kill the entire family. It would have been laughable. Drugs were widely used across the United States. They were for sale in magazines and at pharmacies without a prescription, and the people that sold and used them provided the discourse of the day for drug use. Drug users, and even self-described addicted people at the time, were seldom poor, they were usually employed, and they were usually involved with their families and local communities before the war on drugs began. The people who drew up the war on drugs understood a thing or two about what Foucault is talking about. They didn't try to change the discourse that we had by hammering away at the drugs we weren't afraid of, the cannabis tincture or coca wine we were drinking. Oh no. Instead, they found something we already feared, non-white people in the United States, and they duct-taped drugs to those identities. First, they renamed the chemicals. Cannabis became marijuana, morphine solution became smokable opium, coca wine and soda, available at your whites-only pharmacy until mail-order catalogs showed up, it became cocaine, and then newspapers began to report things like, for example, cocaine causes black men to become immune to bullets and start assaulting white women. Unlike the Sears and Roebuck catalog, where heroin was sold in a kit with two needles and a wooden carrying case for under $2 until the 1900s, These discourses of drug use were scary and racist enough to convince the U.S. public to change course in the early 1900s and to wage a war against ourselves. In the 100 years since, we've only managed to add more drugs, more stigma, and more lies to the equation. Heroin is a ghetto threat to suburbia in the 1960s and 70s. Crack is a zombie-making drug sold by teenage super predators. Fentanyl is in xylazine today, both of which have long histories of safe use in medicine that were quickly forgotten by the public with the new scary government-sponsored discourse of it will kill you, it will make you sell out your family, it's the reason our homeless problem and our overdose crisis are exploding. The beat goes on, but learning enough about power and how it works through discourse construction to challenge it, to blueprint it, to uncover it, to detail it and poke holes in it, that gives us a way to stand at the front lines of discourse evolution and to help pull the reins towards harm reduction, life enhancement, community connection. We can center the stories of drug users and reshape what that public discourse looks like. I know this episode was a lot, but it should pave the way for an upcoming episode revisiting the notion of 12-step and abstinence-only programs that do more harm than good, yet remain the taken-for-granted norm, the status quo, the discourse you're going to encounter if somebody discovers you're struggling with addiction. But that episode's for another day. Thanks for listening. I'm Ben Boyce.
In order to answer the question, what are we now? We have to consider that we are thinking beings, since it is through thought that we are beings who look for truth, who accept or refuse obligations, laws, coercitions, and who are related to ourselves or to the others. My aim is not to answer the general question, what is a thinking being? My aim is to answer the question, how did the history of our thought, I mean of our relation to truth, to obligations, to ourselves and to the others, make us what we are? In brief, how could we analyze the formation of ourselves through the history of our thought?